Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 9, which I will entitle, Idolaters Are Killed. We begin now reading in verse 1 and going to verse 2. Then I heard him call out in a loud voice. I guess I should place the context here. Ezekiel is still in the midst of his house vision. He had a vision by the river Chebar first, then he had a vision in the plain near the river Chebar second, and then he had a vision inside of his house. And he's in the middle of that vision right now, where a figure like a man, whom I assume was Jesus, grabbed him by the hair in the vision and carried him across the desert all the way to Jerusalem. And if you recall, in the last chapter, chapter 8, Jesus, or this divine man, this divine figure, showed Ezekiel four places of idolatry in the temple. Extreme, gross idolatry. So we're in the middle of that vision here. The last verse of chapter 8, verse 18, says this, "Therefore I, that's God, will respond with wrath. I will not show pity or spare them. Though they cry out in my ears with a loud voice, I will not listen to them." Why is God not going to show any pity? Because of the four idolatrous situations which were chronicled in chapter 8. So in verse 1, "Then I, Ezekiel, heard God call out in a loud voice." The voice is loud because that shows that God is angry. So God calls out, "Bring the guards of the city here, each with a weapon in his hand." And I saw six men coming from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with a deadly weapon in his hand. With them was a man clothed in linen who had a writing kit at his side. They came in and stood beside the bronze altar. Now, who were these six guards of the city who came in into the vision, if you will, into the temple? Well, there's a lot of speculation on that. Here's option number one from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. They were the guardian angels of Jerusalem. Now, how he knows that, I don't know. Adam Clark says, "The six angels were those in the Babylonian army who were in charge of destroying the city." So the guards were mere Babylonian military officials with their weapons, and they're getting ready to wipe out the temple. That makes more sense to me than guardian angels of Jerusalem. Well, option number two is soldiers in the Babylonian army officers. Option number three, God's angels of wrath. This is from Albert Barnes. Here's option number four from Adam Clark, the seven counselors of eastern monarchs. Let me read you from Clark. "These may represent the seven counselors of the eastern monarchs who always saw the king's face and knew all the secrets of the government. One of them was that minister who had the office of reporting concerning criminals, who carried the book of death and the book of life into the presence of the king, where the names were entered of criminals who were destined to suffer, and of those who were either considered as innocent or recommended to mercy, those of the former in the book of death, those of the latter in the book of life." Well, this is going to be close to what happens when we see this man in linen with the writing kit. But I think the easiest answer to this is these guards are the seven generals of the army of the Babylonians who are coming in to destroy. But I think the easiest way to locate and designate who these guards are, they are the guards, the military commanders of the Babylonian army who are coming in to destroy the temple. Now, they came into the temple from the direction of the upper gate, it says in verse 2. In our last chapter, we talked about two gates on the northern edge of the temple between the outer court and the inner court. The outer court was where everybody could go. The inner court was where only the priests could go. This is Solomon's temple. There wasn't all the other, probably, court of the women and all that other stuff. Just a simple layout there. And probably, but not definitely, there were two northern gates, one further to the west, which when you went through it, you would be facing the temple wall. And the northeastern gate, as you go through it, you would be facing the bronze altar. Now, in the gate facing the bronze altar, there was an idol that provoked God to jealousy. In the gate, if there was a separate gate, to the west of that first gate, there were women weeping for Tammuz, who was probably Adonis, who had been killed by a boar, Adonis being the lover of Venus, and all the women cried for Adonis. At any rate, pagan stuff going on at these two gates. Now, I'm going to assume, just for the sake of description here, that the six men are coming in through the northeastern gate. Through the gate at the upper entranceway lay the idol that provoked God to jealousy. You go a little bit further into the temple courtyard. Moving south, you hit the altar, a bronze altar. You go south a little bit further, and you hit Ahaz's idolatrous altar that he had put in front of the temple door, moving the true bronze altar a little bit further to the north. So, you got the bronze altar surrounded to the south by a false idolatrous altar, and to the north by an idol that provoked God to jealousy. Now, this gate faced north. Of course, north is the direction from which Babylon always came. They couldn't go east across the Arabian desert to get straight to Jerusalem. They had to go north and east up the Mesopotamian Valley, and then they had to cross the Euphrates River as that river bent going towards the west, going from east to west. The Babylonian army would come from the north, and so, as Adam Clark says, whenever you see north, you're talking about Babylonia. This gate is called the upper gate because there would be a gate at the bottom of the stairs and a gate at the top of the stairs, probably some kind of a gate construction that's enclosed with a roof and walls, the upper end of the stairway there. Into the courtyard of the priest come these six men. They had a deadly weapon in their hand. That means they're getting ready to kill some people. With them was a man clothed in linen. Now that man made up a total of seven men coming into the temple. Seven, of course, is the number of perfection and maturity because there was going to be a perfect disaster coming upon the people of Jerusalem. And a perfect disaster on the temple, which was full of idols. Now there was a man clothed in linen. Who was this man? Some people say he was Gabriel. John Gill says he was Jesus in human form, and Ellicott says that many commentators actually hold that view. I have trouble with that because a divine figure who looked like a man had carried Ezekiel to Jerusalem in vision, took him by the hair, if you recall, in the last chapter, and I assumed that would be Jesus. So if Jesus had carried Ezekiel to the vision, it would be strange to me that he would then retreat from the temple and then come back again clothed in linen. I don't know, that seems sort of strange to me. Another option as to who this man was, he's just some unknown being. It doesn't matter who he was. He's an angel, if you will. Barnes says a seventh angel of wrath, seven being the number of perfection and completion. Here's what Barnes says. The angel of the covenant, the great high priest, superior to those by whom he was surrounded, receiving direct communication from the Lord, taking the coals of vengeance from between the cherubim, but coming with mercy to the contrite as well as with vengeance to the impenitent. These are attributes of Jesus Christ. Barnes also says that the linen that the man was wearing was the clothing of a priest, and so this is an angel of wrath, behaving like a priest, according to Barnes. Of course, Barnes assumes the first six men are not Babylonian generals, but are six angels of destruction. Well, all of that is speculative. It doesn't really matter. The man is wearing linen, which represents righteousness because it's pure and white, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the man wearing the linen was a priest. As Ellicott says, others wore linen simply to show purity or distinction. Now, the man was carrying a writing kit. That's the NIV translation. KJV has inkhorn, whatever that means. Let's describe this writing kit by using a quotation from Barnes. Usually a flat case about 9 inches long by 1.25 inches broad and 1/2 inch thick, the hollow of which serves to contain the reed pens and penknife. A penknife is like a pocket knife. At one end is the ink vessel, which is twice as heavy as the shaft. The whole is usually of polished metal, brass, copper, or silver. So that's a good translation, a writing kit. It's got reed pens in it. It's got ink in it. It's long and thin, like a pencil case. I don't know why a penknife would be in it, pocket knife. Here are some options as to what the writing kit was for. What was its purpose? Barnes says it was to write down in the Book of Life the names of the elect. The elect, of course, being those who were to be saved from the Babylonians as the destruction comes in. Another commentator says the book was used to take account of all the pain and suffering of the elect. I don't think so. I think it's talking about who's going to be in the Book of Life and who's not. Who's going to be delivered from this catastrophe that's coming and who is not. Now the seven men came in through that gate and stood by the bronze altar. So they passed the idol of jealousy, and they stopped at the bronze altar. That's the legitimate bronze altar, not Ahab's false altar, I assume. Poole agrees with me on that. He said that the seven did not stand near the fake Ahab altar, but near the bronze altar. Why were they there? Well, it wasn't to offer sacrifice, obviously. They're waiting for their orders to take vengeance for the sins committed in the temple. The bronze altar is just mentioned to locate the man in linen and his six compadres. It was not mentioned to show that they were about to offer a sacrifice on it. We go now to Ezekiel 9, verses 3 through 6. Now the glory of the God of Israel went up from above the cherubim, where it had been, and moved to the threshold of the temple. Then the Lord called to the man clothed in linen, who had the writing kit at his side, and said to him, Go throughout the city of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of those who grieve and lament over all the detestable things that are done in it. As I listened, he said to the others, Follow him through the city and kill, without showing pity or compassion. Slaughter old men, young men, and maidens, women and children, but do not touch anyone who has the mark. Begin at my sanctuary. So they began with the elders who were in front of the temple. Now in verse 3, the cherubim are mentioned. The cherubim are angels, which are usually sentry angels, guardian angels, if you will. The glory of the Lord went up from above those cherubim. These are two particular cherubim who are located at the end of the mercy seat. The mercy seat being the top of the ark, which is in the Holy of Holies, the ark containing the two tablets of the testimony where the Ten Commandments were inscribed. Aaron's rod, which budded, was in there, and God was above it in the cloud of Shekinah glory, the ark being his footstool. Now, if you recall in the last chapter, when Ezekiel first arrived at the temple in his vision, the glory of God was there, probably in the courtyard where all this stuff was going on. But now, the glory of God is in the Holy of Holies, between the cherubim. And then the Shekinah glory moved to the threshold of the temple. So he went from the Holy of Holies, through the holy place, through the front door of the holy place, and that's the threshold of the temple, because the door that led into the holy place was the door that led into the temple. And so he's there, right as you look out into the temple courtyard, the inner court of the priest. He's looking out. The glory of God is there. And from there, God calls to the man clothed in linen who had the writing kit and said, Okay, I want you to go throughout the city of Jerusalem and put a mark on the foreheads of those who grieve and lament over all the detestable things that are done in the city. In other words, this mark was going to be a mark of salvation. And so the reason the Shekinah glory went to the threshold of the temple is because God was directing the seven ministers of death to come to the threshold and to go from there out into the city and start whacking people. Now, what might this mark be an allusion to? There are speculations, and there are speculations. You could just not worry about it and say it's a mark. But here are some options as to what that mark might allude to. Option number one, the marking of Israelites on the night of the Exodus, Exodus 12, 22 through 23. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood which is in the basin, and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintel and the two doorposts. And none of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning, for the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. And so the mark is referring back to the mark of blood that's put on the doorpost of the Israelites in the Exodus. I think that's a stretch. Option number two, the mark is alluding to the ancient custom, which was used everywhere, of setting marks on servants and slaves to distinguish them from others. That's Adam Clark, who mentions that as an option. A little mundane, but very reasonable. Option number three. Adam Clark says it was common for worshippers to have their idol's mark upon their foreheads and arms. Clark says they are called, quote-unquote, sectarian marks to the present day among the Hindus and others in India. And so even as the pagans marked their worshippers, their idol worshippers, so God is marking the true worshippers of God. I think that's a stretch. Here's another speculation adopted by Adam Clark, but disputed by many other people, that the mark was a cross symbolizing Christ. Clark says Jerome says that this Hebrew letter tau was formerly written like a cross. The Hebrew letter tau is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. In modern Hebrew, it does not look like a cross, but apparently Jerome thought it did. In ancient times, Jerome, of course, is the famous 5th century, I think that's his dates, 5th century B.C. Catholic scholar. So then the people were to be signed with the sign of the cross, these people who were marked by the man in linen. It is certain that on the ancient Samaritan coins, which are yet extant, the letter Tau is in the form of a cross, which is what we term St. Andrew's Cross. Many people dispute that, and I don't believe that. I just think it means that it's some kind of mark to show that God is not going to kill them because they've been faithful. And the purpose of that is to show that I don't care how bad the judgment is, God always rescues a remnant. That should be comforting for those of us who are living in the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah, waiting for the judgment to come, as we have become so perverted and so morally filthy that we look like the inside of a septic tank. God is going to preserve his remnant. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown says this concerning the mark. We seal what we wish to guard securely. When all things else on earth are confounded, God will secure his people from the common ruin. Now, Jameson Fawcett and Brown make the point that there could be an objection to this because there were many people in Jerusalem who were not protected, godly people. For example, Jeremiah. How about Daniel? He was carried off into exile. How about Ezekiel himself? And not only that, some of the people who were left behind and who weren't conquered by the Babylonians, the rump that's left in the land, there were probably some nasty, vile people amongst those. Well, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the X, the mark, is to show that some people would be saved eternally, not that they would be exempt from all temporal suffering, but from that which will prove really and lastingly hurtful, in other words, hell. They're saved from hell. It's not really a temporal salvation that is meant by this mark, but an eternal salvation. Well, I think that makes some sense, but somehow I keep thinking that this is referring to deliverance from the Babylonian army. Temporal salvation. I can't be sure. I do know that John used this reference in Ezekiel 9 to refer to the sealing of the 144,000 in Revelation chapter 7. We read in verse 3, "Don't harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we seal the slaves of our God on their foreheads." The slaves of our God are believers. That's referring to the Christian Jews in Jerusalem who escaped the Roman siege in 66 AD when they all left and went to Pella, about 40 miles to the northeast of Jerusalem, right there on the edge of the Jordan River. That was temporal salvation. Now, that's an Orthodox preterist view. I realize that. But since that's the correct view, I'm going to mention it. Well, whether it's temporal or eternal salvation, it does show that God cares about the remnant in the midst of judgment. He cared about the 8 people in the boat floating on the waters of the universal flood. He cared about those guys. He cared about the Jews who he rescued from the judgment that was carried out on Egypt during the times of the Exodus. There's always a remnant, folks, even in the middle of the worst sin and idolatry. So there were people grieving over the sin in the land, in Jerusalem. We read that in verse 4. The mark goes on the foreheads of those who grieve, even as righteous Lot was vexed when he looked what was going on around him in Sodom. There were people in Jerusalem that were grieving over the abject desecration of the true religion. So in verse 5, as I listened, as Ezekiel listened, he, that's God, said to the others, that means the other 6 angels or soldiers or whatever they were, for a total of 7, follow him, follow the man in linen, you other 6, go through the city and kill, don't show pity or compassion, slaughter old men, young men and maidens, women and children. Now, normally women and children are not slain in war, but this shows how horribly upset God was at what was going on. Now, remember, God didn't actually do this directly. The Babylonians did it. But women and children are not exempt from judgment because of their gender or their age when judgment comes upon a whole nation. Now, the marking and the destruction, well, no marking is going to happen to the elders in front of the temple. They're all going down. The elders were in front of the temple, and these were the elders who were ruling Jerusalem, the political elders, and the 7 went out whacking, starting with those elders. These are the 70 rulers of Israel that were mentioned in the last chapter. Let me read that, Ezekiel 8, verses 10 through 11. I went in and looked, and there engraved all around the wall was every form of detestable thing, crawling creatures and beasts, as well as all the idols of the house of Israel. In our last chapter, we decided that these images, these idolatrous images, were on the walls of the priest's quarters, right at the entrance to the inner court from the outer court on the east side. In verse 11, 70 elders from the house of Israel were standing before them. So this is the same general area where the man in linen and his six helpers are getting ready to start killing people. 70 elders from the house of Israel were standing before them, with Jazaniah son of Shaphan standing among them. Each had a fire pan in his hand, and a fragrant cloud of incense was rising up. In other words, they were committing idolatry, and in the midst of their idolatry, these seven are going to come in and whack them. We go now to Ezekiel 9, verses 7 through 11, and we will finish this chapter. Then he, that's God, said to them, that's the seven, defile the temple and fill the courts with the slain. Go! So they went out and began killing throughout the city. While they were killing, and I was left alone, I fell face down, crying out, Ah, sovereign Lord, are you going to destroy the entire remnant of Israel in this outpouring of your wrath on Jerusalem? He answered me, The sin of the house of Israel and Judah is exceedingly great. The land is full of bloodshed, and the city is full of injustice. They say, The Lord has forsaken the land, the Lord does not see. So I will not look on them with pity or spare them, but I will bring down on their own heads what they have done. Then the man in linen with the writing kit at his side brought back word, saying, I have done as you commanded. The slaughter is over. That's not in the text. That's what I'm saying. The slaughter is over. Now in verse 7, when God tells the seven, defile the temple with all the dead bodies of the slain, fill the courts with the slain, that would be starting with the 70 elders who were all killed there in the courtyard. It's interesting that God would say defile the temple. It had already been thoroughly defiled by all the idolatry that was taking place within the precincts. God defiling the temple with dead bodies didn't really make it much worse than it already was. And notice that God is not actually doing all the killing. This is in a vision here. It was the Babylonians who were the ones directly responsible for all the killing. Now in verse 8, Ezekiel says, while they were killing and I was left alone, he was left alone because everybody else in the temple was killed. No one got marked in the temple. No one was saved from destruction. And Ezekiel starts feeling the weight of this. He falls down on his face and says, are you going to kill everybody? Are you going to destroy the entire remnant of Israel? Now remember, Judah was the remnant of Israel, the remaining two tribes out of the original 12. The northern 10 tribes have been hauled off into captivity by the Assyrians under Sargon II in 722 BC. So Judah is already a remnant. And then Ezekiel says, are you going to destroy this remnant of Israel, Judah, completely? The answer was pretty much yes, because Judah, the remnant, was destroyed, except for the marked righteous ones who are going to survive. Now, Ezekiel should have known, I guess, that there was going to be a remnant of the remnant left, because he heard the command to mark all those who would be saved. Now, it could be that he thought that as the seven went out, that nobody would get the mark. That was going to be total disaster. Everybody was going to be killed. I can understand that, because things look pretty bad from his point of view. But the marked righteous ones, they survived. They were a remnant of a remnant. Now, the question that Ezekiel asked was answered by God in verse 9. He says, look, the sin of Israel and Judah is so great. The land is full of bloodshed. The city is full of injustice. That's why I'm whacking so many people. I'm not going to pity them. I'm not going to spare them. I'm going to bring down on their heads what they have done. So you're just going to have to live with that. This judgment is just. Now notice in verse 9 that God, in answering Ezekiel, says the sin of the house of Israel and Judah is exceedingly great. So God is including the sins of the defunct northern 10 tribes of Israel in with the current sins of Judah. The two were considered one. They were both Israel. As we saw in the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah constantly referred to Judah as Israel because they were the representatives, the sole surviving tribes of the 12 tribes of Israel. So when we make a distinction between Israel and Judah, there has to be a reason for it in the context. There is not here. All of Israel is going down because of all of their sins. And so in verse 11, the man in the linen comes back to the temple, back to the glory of God, back to Ezekiel, and says to God, not to Ezekiel, he says to God, I have done as you commanded. Whole lot of people are destroyed because of their sin. On that somber note, we have now finished Ezekiel 9. We are prepared to go in our next audio to Ezekiel 10, which I will call The Glory of the Lord Leaves the Temple. Not surprisingly. We'll see you in our next audio. I hope you enjoyed the discussion of Ezekiel chapter 9.